I haven't really woken up. Oh, until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.
Hey there, animation fans, and welcome to another episode of the AFA podcast, the official podcast for animationforadults.com. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, all that good stuff. We are here for our holiday special where we get to talk about a holiday-themed movie. My name is Rachel, and joining me today is one of our new commentators for the podcast. You've heard him on our Fantasia episode. This is Evan. Hey, Evan.
Hey, everybody. Hey, Rachel.
Ooh, it is that time of the year again, and I have to tell you, Christmas, holidays, what's going to feel different this year, obviously, with everything that's happened in 2020, but I think the whole, you know, peace on earth, goodwill toward men is really needed right now. Like, it's, I don't think, like, the messages of Christmas have been more important than they have been this year, and I really hope people out there are taking that to heart, and we're going to talk about a film that I know you're a big fan of. I've only seen it a couple times since it came on Netflix in 2019, and that is the film that was released on Netflix that is Klaus. And this is a very, like, people who, if any of you out there who have seen the look of this movie through the trailers, or if you haven't yet to actually sit down and watch it, if you have seen it, you know, it has a very unique look to it for an animated film. Like, it, we'll get to the depths of that, but it is at its forefront a story of the origin of Santa Claus, or as he's called in this film, Klaus, and how the whole origin of the idea of mailing Santa letters, where that supposedly all began. So, Evan, do you want to take it away with, like, a maybe a small summary of, like, the, like, kind of like the what do you call that in film again, like the, yeah, the byline, like, yeah, like the byline, the what is the film about?
Yeah, so for anyone who hasn't seen the film, and after this episode we certainly hope you do, the film takes place, it's in a fictional setting, presumably in some, you know, fictional Scandinavian country, I think in the like maybe the 19th century? Would you say maybe the 19th century, Rachel, like mid 1800s?
I'd wager a guess, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so Jesper Johansen is a spoiled heir to this like postal company. His father's the CEO. Jesper is going through training to become a postman, but is super entitled, doesn't want to do a lick of work. So his father, to whip him into shape, sends him to Smeerensburg, which is this really remote island to the far north, and tells him that he has a year to sell, to mail 6,000 letters. I think it was 6,000.
Yeah, 6,000 letters in 1 year.
Or he'll be disinherited. So Jesper has a real conundrum. He's used to his silk sheets and his comfy bed, and
he loves talking about those sheets. He loves talking about those silk sheets.
He does, and I'm sure if you've seen the film, animation fans, you're probably chuckling at that, because that's kind of you know, a thing with Jesper's sheets, like Rachel said. But yeah, without I'll try to be concise, but basically Jesper goes to Smeerensburg, and he, you know, is there initially for completely selfish reasons. He wants to get back home. He wants to get this over with. And he finds the town just completely barren. The two warring families, the I think it's the Crumbs and the Ellingbows, have been fighting each other for centuries, since the beginning of time even. Absolutely hate each other. The town's really bleak. The color palette's just, like, very gray. Nobody's happy. Everybody hates each other. And for that reason, they never send mail. So Jesper's got a problem. He's got to figure out how to get 6,000 letters mailed in a town that doesn't mail letters. Well, one thing leads to another. He bumps into Klaus, who is a reclusive toy maker that secretly gives away his you know, like little trinkets to children at night to make them feel happy. So Jesper knows the children of the town have taken a liking to Klaus, and he essentially uses Klaus initially as a way to get children to send letters. He convinces the kids, and Rachel, if you think I'm missing anything, you can go ahead and interject.
But yeah, you're being very thorough. I'm
awesome.
I'm,
yeah. I'll try to wrap it up here, but basically, Jesper, coaxes the kids into writing letters to Mr. Klaus, so that they can get toys. And that's kind of how this sort of Santa Claus figure is born in Smearensburg. I won't give away the ending and what happens at the end, because we want to save that for people who haven't seen the film. But
good idea.
Eventually, as Jesper gets the letters mailed and gets to know Klaus and the kids and sees the joy that the toys are bringing them, and the conflict between the Ellingbos and the Crumbs dissolving as a result of that, he starts to have a change of heart. He realizes, mm-hmm. you know, maybe the silk sheets and the riches aren't everything. I'm not sure if I want to leave this. That's kind of the choice he has to make. Does he go mm-hmm. back after the letters have been mailed? Or does he stay with Klaus to continue to bring joys to kids? Mm-hmm. That's the story.
Yeah, it's a deceptively simple premise, because there's so much character and personality packed into everybody that comes in on screen. Every kid that you see in this town has a unique look, has a unique they really bring this whole film to life. This is a film that's just oozing character and personality out of every pore, and it's something to really can just kind of let wash over you, because that's how, basically, when my first viewing of this film last Christmas, there was just so much to look at. I mean, like you said, there's the amazing color shift from when you first arrive, you first see Smearensburg, and how you've got these dark, like ominous gray tones and like ramshackle buildings. And then as, you know, the mood starts to change and, you know, the kids start becoming more excited for these toys, and that starts affecting the whole town. Like the color palette reflects that, with having those really amazing like oranges and bright colors just really popping. And yeah. I love that kind of the way that they kind of helped use like the what's the word I'm looking for, the design. Gosh, I why can't I talk today? The design of the film helps facilitate the story, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. It feels like everything, every little detail that they put in this film for visuals, definitely all was for like to help move the story, or help really give those key story moments just like that extra bump that it needed to really sell the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree with you, Rachel. Visual aspect of the film, the visual aspect of any animated film is half the story, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a world that belongs entirely to the director. It's not live action. You're in this kind of universe that's almost like a dream. We are entering Sergio Pablo's, the director's dream, and experiencing Smearensburg through that kind of subjective lens that belongs to him and him alone. If you're listening to this podcast, you're an animation fan, you might have already thought that, when you think about your favorite animated film, there's that element of subjectivity that goes into the aesthetic that makes the viewing experience very personal. It's special, really saturated. The aesthetic's different. I don't know if we want to talk about that later or now, but it's kind of 2D, but also has this 3D look to it.
Yeah, and I did. Yeah, go ahead, go for it.
No, I was just saying it's not like any other animated film you've seen. I mean, it's a Christmas film, which makes it sound like it's kind of, you know, like some sort of brand film, you know, like we've seen other Santa Claus movies, but you really haven't. The story is sweet, but the look is wildly different. But go ahead, Rachel. Sorry.
No, it's cool. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about the story first before we get into the technical aspects. But yeah, it's in terms of like the characters, like, I mean, like you said, there's Santa Claus movies around this time of year. They're like a dime a dozen. Like you can just flip any channel this time of year and you'll find like another film that's even remotely like focused, like a fantasy, like family film that spoke has, you know, Santa Claus as a major protagonist. But I really like how they characterize Klaus in this film. I think he's definitely a lot, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's not the way I'm used to seeing the character, this icon portrayed. And I think that was probably the things that really kind of sold me. Not just the fact that Jesper goes through a really very compelling character arc. But the fact that both of them really work off each other very well. Mm-hmm. And you kind of like have Klaus as like this, his straight man to Jesper's funny man, which I'm not used to seeing Santa being a straight man, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of like yin and yang almost. Is that what you're driving at? Like
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you watch the story, and that's one thing that's kind of surprising about Klaus, like you said, right, Rachel? He's not all ho ho ho, you know, merry. He's not the Santa Claus that you envision at the beginning of the story. Mm-hmm. That behavior is explained in the film, and again, I don't want to betray any spoilers because Klaus has a rather dramatic backstory.
Oh yes,
but
that was a surprise.
Yeah, and it's a tearjerker for sure. He's a man that he's sunk into himself, for lack of a better term, I guess. You know that he's kind, but because of the loss that he's experienced, he's afraid to be vulnerable. And even though Jesper is this kind of, you know, selfish socialite who's using him, it is interesting to see their relationship evolve, because Jesper kind of almost, I don't know if you'd agree with this, it feels like he allows Klaus to get in touch with the lost part of himself, mm-hmm. because Jesper has no issue talking to people, you know, mm-hmm. and that's, and Klaus is so withdrawn. Klaus's selflessness helps Jesper too. So it's kind of, you know, like a trade-off almost, you know, mm-hmm. one man saves the other in his own way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like that kind of that dynamic that they have. Like one brings one out of his shell. Like you definitely see that over the course of the film, you know, at first Klaus barely says a word, like maybe like a couple words here and there, but then he and Jesper start having actual conversations later on in the film. And you see him take more of a you know, talk to a lot more people. And like especially as it gets like into the latter portions of the film. Whereas, like you said, Jesper, again, very much out for himself and getting this goal met so he can leave. But then, like you said, that selflessness and kindness that Klaus has been sharing through their partnership begin to rub off on him as well. Mm-hmm. And there's something, like one of my favorite scenes in the film, like we'll just, because this is early in the film, so I don't think it'd be really classified as a spoiler, but I just want to kind of touch on it because in a story point, in terms of like, have you heard the phrase, I know there's like a book on script writing that is goes by the same title, Save the Cat. Are you familiar with that?
No, but I'll bet there are a lot of listeners who aren't either. Could you kind of brief us on what that means?
And I'll have to look up the author, in a minute, because for some reason the name's not coming to me, but the idea of Save the Cat, that's basically the moment in your story where you have a character, whether it's your protagonist or someone else, who basically they go out of their way to, you know, depending on however else you've characterized them as,
this is the element, this is the scene that's supposed to serve like, oh, this is someone relatable. This is someone who I can get behind. This is someone I can root for. And that is like, say, like you have this character who's like, oh, you look like, looks like you wouldn't be a nice guy, but then he saves a cat. Like, oh no, he is someone I can get behind. And one scene that really jumped out to me that was basically the save the cat was that first scene where you have Jesper and Klaus drop off that first present to the little boy. And I mean, obviously that like that's very much like the save the cat moment for Klaus himself, but you know, at the same time, we come to expect that from people we typically portray, you know, it's like, oh, this is Santa Claus. Of course that's the case. But I'm trying to think if that's like, I don't know if that same scene serves as the same purpose for Jesper. I don't know when, I'm trying to remember, I think his, when his scene was in terms of that kind of story writing, like it kind of, that's the one thing about this film that kind of confuses me sometimes. It's like, I'm surprised that they give Jesper's just as like a very, again, a very selfish motivation. And then just good things start happening, you know, good things start happening to Klaus and the town as a result of it. And that's what changes him. But I'm just trying to think if there's any one scene or any one moment, at least early on in the film. Oh, actually, I know when it was. It wasn't actually that scene. It was later on when he's proposing the idea of to Klaus to go and deliver toys at night. And he's approaching him. You know, he's approaching Klaus, so he's chopping wood, and he's like, it's like, okay, probably not an axe murderer, but a good guy deep down. Like, okay, so yeah. he knows good when he sees it.
Yeah. It takes one to know one, right?
Yeah. So,
yeah, I completely agree, Rachel. It's kind of hard to, because Jesper has such a gradual redemption arc, it's hard to find that one moment where, you know, you save the cat, right? Where you, mm-hmm. you have, find that element of relatability, and I'm like, oh yeah, Jesper's cool. But the fact that he can recognize good means that there is good in him too, right? You know?
Yeah. I mean, how much of that he's buried underneath his entitlement and whatever, but it's there. It's definitely there. And yeah. We get to see that encouraged more out of him as the film goes on. Especially when he starts to see the impact that he and Klaus have had on the town. Really briefly, let's talk about the town, because it's a place full of personalities. That's for sure. Like that's like it, the town is kind of like a character in and of itself, just because of the wide variety of people we see and the kids that we get to know. Even if some of these people aren't named, like you look at their designs are so, their character designs are so well defined. I feel terrible that before this podcast, I didn't take the time to look up who the character designer was for this film or the character designers, because they did an amazing job making sure that every person in this town who's on screen, like you knew who they were. Like you had the old lady who threw bad bath water in the neighbor's sheets. You had the kids in the neighborhood who basically take this guy in his rocking chair and do all manner of terrible things to this poor old man in a rocking chair.
Yeah. I can't verify this because I haven't seen it written anywhere, but I wonder, maybe this is just me, if Pablo's or his designers drew some inspiration from Henry Selick or Tim Burton, because mm-hmm. some of the character designs vaguely reminded me of that look. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm thinking about like the three kids standing around the snowman.
Oh my God.
With the carrot. Pushing
oh my God. Yes. That's one of the greatest visual jokes in terms of like getting the pulse for this town, even before we get introduced to the big problem this place has. And you have these kids sitting around a snowman and this little girl taking the carrot and just stabbing it into the snowman like a knife. It's just like, oh my God.
It may have just been that moment, but for a split second, I thought, oh, this looks like a Tim Burton character design, because he's got like the big eyes, the round head, you know, black clothing, black hair, and just that like creepy little like wide-eyed stare while she shoves the carrot into the snowman.
Oh my God. And then you've got like, there's again, even those little things in there in and of itself, like seeing those characters change over the course of the film is a real reward. Yeah. Because it's just like you get this wonderful introduction to everybody and like mostly everybody in the town, and then you get to see all of that slowly change over the course of Klaus and Jesper's partnership. I love then again the designs talking about the difference between the two families. You have the let me make sure the Crumbs and the
Ellenbows.
Yes, they have, again, two distinct designs. Like the Crumbs are kind of very tall and angular designs, whereas the Crumbs are large and more rounded. And you can see that whenever you have look from between one member of the family, even though all of them, you've got kids, you've got, grown adults, you've got, elderly members of the family, like they all have those kind of shape design elements to them to distinguish one from the other.
I never noticed that, but that's a great point. The Ellingbows, if I'm not mixing up the family names, look more emaciated, and the color palette kind of complements that too, because they have that like darker, like gray black color going for them.
Yeah, like that's the Crumbs. Yeah, they're very.
I'm flipping them. Yeah,
it's okay. It's totally fine to do that. But yeah, they're again the very like you said, the dark color palettes with all their clothes and hair. And then the Ellenbows all have this bright red hair, red puffy hair. I really love the one design of the father of the little boy that we were talking about that one scene earlier. He's just this skeleton of a man with this just tall hat, like, and this long hair, like almost like I'm trying to think of what like design that like time period he's supposed to like represent looking at, because he's got like the balded head, but the rest of his hair is all long on the side. Like I love that design.
He looks like an undertaker.
He does.
I mean, he practically was an undertaker for Jesper, right? When they were dropping off the gift.
Oh yeah. I mean, him and his dogs. Yeah. Him and his dogs.
Not a very nice guy.
No, at least until he broke his leg and then the kids helped him out. And then he seemed to start coming around.
He's got a soft side.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about the town. We talked about Klaus. Any other characters you want to talk about really quick that really stuck out to you in the story?
We haven't talked about Alva.
Alva, yes.
Yeah, important.
Yes, she is. She's actually kind of part of a big part of what helps Jesper along is that the kid starts saying, well, we want to write letters to Klaus, but we can't write or read. It's like, well, there is a teacher in town who has, unfortunately, for the longest time, not been able to be a teacher, if you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah. There's this kind of odd, like how I met your mother moment almost between Jesper and Alva. Alva, if nobody caught that, is Jesper's eventual love interest in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But she's this kind of discouraged. Her character is kind of similar to Klaus in many ways, because Klaus is a discouraged toy maker and Alva is a discouraged school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
She hasn't gone through the same trauma that Klaus has, but when Jesper finds her, she's been there for, I think, a couple of years.
Five years, I think I remember her saying exactly. It was 5 years.
Rachel
she's
knows
been the there. Well, only because I just watched the film this morning, so it's like a lot of the details are still very fresh.
No, that's good, because we need to be accurate for the super fans. We know you're out there. This is an awesome movie, but anyway, Alva went to Smeritzburg because she wanted to be a teacher. She got discouraged because the Crumb Ellingbow conflict was basically keeping kids from school. Nobody was really interested in learning. They're too busy fighting. Mm-hmm. And just the kind of general bleakness of the town crushed her spirit. So Jesper finds her as a fishmonger. She's kind of got this almost like butcher shop set up in what was her classroom. And she cuts up fish all day and is really mean and just wants people to buy her stuff so she can save up money and get out of Smeerensburg, get out of Dodge, however you want to say it. As Jesper and Klaus start to restore the town, Jesper also gets to know Alva. He starts to reawaken the teacher in her, ironically, mm-hmm. because she doesn't understand that what he's doing was initially selfish, but she's inspired mm-hmm. by him, and he's inspired by her because he knows that what she does isn't a facade, and he starts to question his own morals.
Exactly.
But anyway, without being too long-winded, Alva opens a school back up, and the kids absolutely love her. She finds herself again, just like mm-hmm. Klaus, and really just kind of like Jesper. They grow together.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, in regards to that her first introduction scene, I love the touch, especially with the mirroring the evolution, these certain key details that would, like I said, if show the evolution of this class, of her and her classroom, mm-hmm. Like her person, like that kind of, I guess that you could say they kind of mirror each other. Like when you first get introduced, like you said, that you've got the fish hanging from string, you know, from like hanging off the walls and strung up in this classroom. And I love this detail by her desk. She's got a globe, and inside the globe are all her cutting knives.
Yeah.
Whenever she's chopping up fish, she just goes and she pulls the knife out of her globe, and then just goes to town on these fish. And then when kids start coming to her classroom, she's first really annoyed. It's like, oh gosh, this is just like, I don't want to have to deal with this. I just want to get out of here still. But you know, and when you look at those, like you see kids having to peek through these hanging fish. Like, can you imagine having to go to class and just be surrounded by that much dead fish?
I mean,
it's gotta stink.
You know, they wanted to learn, right? They were that.
That's dedication for those kids. Like, they were just like, okay, we really, really want to learn to read and write so we can send letters.
Yeah, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the original reason why the kids started coming back to school was because they wanted to write letters to Klaus.
Mm-hmm.
Was that kind of the catalyst there,
Rachel? That is the catalyst because some of the kids admit to Jesper that they can't write, and then he sends the kids her way. And originally I think the kids were just like, okay, we just want to learn how to do this just so we can send letters. But then when she starts teaching them how to write their own name, they're like, oh no, wait, this is cool, teach me other stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what really kind of that's like the spark in Alva to basically say, oh wow, no, this is, I could just be able to pull this off if I put a little more effort into it. And she keeps looking at her savings jars like, do I or don't I?
Yeah, that was just a side comment. That was probably one of the most touching scenes in the film, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When she teaches that first kid how to write her name, and that spark is kind of reignited when everybody else says, oh, I want to know, show me, you know,
mm-hmm.
you realize mm-hmm. it's not about her anymore.
Yeah. And it's good to, and again, as you see the classroom evolve, you see less and less fish. She trades out her old globe, her stabbed hole globe and for a new one. And it's cool to see again, that evolution take place and see how it really comes together at the end.
The room is transformed, and
much like her.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about that. Her appearance changes too, right?
A little bit. She's a lot more like, because in the beginning she's very disheveled, and like you can tell the clothes that she's wearing aren't like, you know, she's probably been having to wear the same clothes like while she's chopping up fish like all day. Very, you know, I would say not necessarily rags, but you definitely tell that like this is the stuff that you can get dirty in.
Yeah.
But then by the time we see her again and the classroom has become an actual classroom, she's got a collared shirt, it's all white pressed and looks great, you know, her hair's not hanging loose, she's got it tied back.
Yeah.
So she's definitely a lot more kempt, for sure. Yeah. Well kempt.
Even her complexion, it's like less peaked. There's a glow in her, and there's a glow mm-hmm. in the room and a glow in a town. You know, you already said that, Rachel, but the hue of Smearensburg, the color saturation, it just brightens, you know, mm-hmm. like as the town transforms because of Klaus and Jesper.
Mm-hmm.
And Alva's kind of like an integral part of that.
Absolutely.
I never really thought about that, honestly, but that's neat. That attention to detail.
I love how those kind of things, like, I love looking for those kind of details, and especially for character, for when it's part of this telling the story, for sure. Yeah. Like, that's, I'm a story girl, so I'm always looking for those elements that are that build on the story, especially after I've seen a film more than once.
Yeah.
And I will say, just as a minor aside, the one character who we are introduced to first, the boat driver, is probably one of my favorite characters, just because you can tell as soon as he realizes that Jesper's a fish out of water, he's just like, I'm going to have the best fun, like the best time of my life making fun of you.
Yeah. Yeah. He's an interesting character. There is probably a name in film or literature for that character type, the mm-hmm. sort of observer who doesn't actively participate mm-hmm. in like the mainstream plot, but is kind of almost like the Jiminy Cricket to like the main character, the guy who just like jumps in every now and then and says, hey, how are things going? You know, with a little bit of sarcasm, but you know, the guy means well, he's not a bad person. You know, he's just, he likes to mess with Jesper, but he's seen it all. And there's some wisdom to him that makes him mm-hmm. interesting.
Absolutely. And especially like when, I won't spoil why, but it's important, like, his observation is actually a very important at the end in terms of how he's seen, at least as far as Jesper is concerned, how his character has changed over the course of the movie. So that's, it's like, you think he's seems like more of a minor character, but even he has an important role to play.
He does. And I know we can't give it away, so you'll have to watch the film if you don't know what we're talking about, but that's a really great point, Rachel, because without him, Jesper's destiny would have been radically different. Mm-hmm. It's just one little line, but he changes everything. So.
Yep. Yeah. But okay, so yeah, we'll don't want to go too in depth on the story since we want people to go and watch it if you haven't already. So we'll move away from talking about characters, but again, kind of aligning to what we were talking about before, there is this a very unique look to this film, and I did a little bit of light research on here, and I know you did as well, Evan, so we'll try to cover different points, and I'll just want to go start with you in terms of what you know about this film's production. But what do you know about the animation style that they opted to use for this film? Because it definitely has a 2D, its animation definitely has 2D origins for sure.
Yeah. This is very baseline. So, as needed, Rachel, if you've got more info here, but
okay,
I think that in making the film, Sergio Pablos, he'd previously worked for Disney Animation, mm-hmm. kind of during like the Renaissance. I think he'd worked on Aladdin, Hunchback of Notre Dame, among other titles, and he was conscious of how I guess like the sort of like Disney aesthetic had gradually shifted from 2D to three-dimensional animation over time. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to create a new aesthetic that would kind of show what 2D, in his mind at least, may have looked like if Disney had stayed the course and continued just animate in 2D. So if that makes sense, he was looking for something that would kind of hybridize the two elements, like make the look of Klaus be very modern, but also very much tethered to like the 2D aesthetic. Mm-hmm. So I can't break down like technically exactly how they got it done, but it was essentially, I think, like a multi-step process of like 3D lighting and texturing mm-hmm. techniques put on top of the two-dimensional frames that made it look like this. And it looks like it was really labor intensive. So this was definitely a passion project. I think they even had to consult like another animation studio.
They did. Yeah. I have it written down here that they did actually have to reach out to another company to basically help perfect this look.
Yeah. But did you want to elaborate on that a little bit, Rachel, if you
Because I wrote down some of it, but not, unfortunately, I didn't have time to get to all of the different points about where the, let me see if I can find it here somewhere.
Not to put you on the spot there. The name, I had it a second ago, the name of that other production company.
Oh, here it is. Les Films du Poisson Rouge.
Oh, French.
Yes, very, very French. But that was the other, that was the name, at the very least, that was the name of the other company that they brought on to help with the animation. But yeah, you're right. It was 3D lighting effects and definitely a lot of emphasis on, you know, like, but here's the thing, from what I remember looking into this, you know, the, because obviously the computer did some of the work and rendering the light. And I forget exactly what the, what's the name of the lighting? It was, because they developed, they gave it a name. It was called Klaus Light and Shadow. So basically KLS. And again, this was a program that was designed to basically kind of help along with, you know, the style of the lighting, depending on and keeping it consistent when you have a character interacting in a scene. It's supposed to like help like realistically reflect that light as like you would see in a 3D animated film. The problem was that, I mean, obviously like with most, when you try to run a 2D, like, or make something look 2D in a three-dimensional program, it doesn't work 100% of the time. Like, because again, you have to kind of teach the computers, like, no, these mistakes, what you perceive as mistakes are intentional. So not only did they, you have the computer getting at least the portion of the work done, but then you had people having to go back, artists having to go back in and basically touch up those, what the computer already rendered in terms of the light and the shadow. And that's, I think that's why the film looks as great as it does, because it was not just, it was a kind of a combination of knowing the tool, knowing this tool could only do so much of the work. You had to have, if it's going to be a real personal or have that personal feeling to it in terms of like the earlier Disney classic films, you had to have that hand-drawn touch to it. Yeah. That artist touch to make sure, like, okay, no, we have to have it like this.
Yeah. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. You know, I myself am not an artist. I have no drawing skill whatsoever, much less the patience to make like a 10-second animation. But it blows me away to think of just about how, you know, stories like this truly are a labor of love, because they are so labor intensive. And I mean, it can take days just to get, you know, a minute of animation done, probably
more. Oh yeah, no, it's, I remember Dan saying this in our Fantasia episode, which you remember when we were talking about the effects in Fantasia, just like, animators are insane. Like, to a certain, there's a certain level of like, is, you know, some you'd think a certain level of insanity that goes into like, okay, we're really gonna break down every minute detail of what makes life what it is. But that's still, I find it incredible that people like that can even, you know, can make such amazing things, because they just have that hyper focus when they set their minds. It's like, okay, no, I'm gonna go at this project with everything I have. And that was very much the case with this film, because you can tell all the people who worked on it had this, you know, were shared the director's vision to the point that they were able to put out this level of quality in their work, to the fact that you had, that you basically invented a whole new way to have lighting and shadow and texture in a 2D animated film. Because even people, because the film will trick you, the thinking with the way that the lighting and texture looks on the characters, like, oh, this is some kind of 3D, right? Wrong. It is a 2D film through and through. It just has a very, it has a new layer of lighting and shadow and texture that has been, you know, people that he's been inspired by those 3D films that we see a lot nowadays.
I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this was, this film was Pablos's directorial debut. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting, you know, moving forth to see if this aesthetic resurfaces, if this kind of becomes his trademark. You know, it may have just been something he engineered for Klaus. But I personally would be thrilled if I saw this again. Like,
I would too, because I am much like him. I'm very fascinated to see 2D animation evolve, and not necessarily like, I don't think every style of animation has its place depending on what type of story you're trying to tell. And because again, the animation is part of, you know, if you've got to match the right style of animation to the right story. Like,
yes,
but I remember watching films, or like one of the Disney shorts, Paper Man, which I know I think had a different different production style in terms of how that film got its look. But it kind of, when I watched or saw the trailers for Klaus, it kind of reminded me a little bit of it, where you kind of had this unique blend of 2D and 3D techniques for character animation. And I'm like, you know, why is Hollywood so eager to just kind of jump the boat on 2D animation just because of a few bad films and just trying to go into whole hog into 3D animation when these things seem to look so good together? Like why must one continue to evolve at the exclusion of the other, you know?
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. You can combine the two and make something better than 2D or 3D standing alone, arguably. You know, some people might disagree if they don't like the way Klaus looks, but
And there have been instances where you have had combination of 2D and 3D where it's been abysmal. Like I know if Chris was here, he'd be talking about the Berserk anime that came out a while back. That was just rough. And it's just like, okay, like there's just certain ways. Like, I mean, obviously this is still kind of like a new frontier for animators and people who are in the animation industry in terms of, okay, how can we, if we're going to try and combine these two mediums, how do we make it work and how do we make it look good? Clearly Berserk was not the way to do that, but we have people, artists who are slowly kind of finding those lines of where you can blend them. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this one, I think it was on Amazon video called Land of the Lustrous. But it is a Japanese anime that is primarily 3D animation, but they kind of did a Disney technique where they had the character animators, the characters were drawn in 2D to kind of act as like the baseline for the actions and animation. And then the models were guided to move along with those 2D drawings. So they kind of like they kind of had the 2D as the base for the animation.
That's interesting. I guess at the end of the day, you just have to be very conscious of what pleases the eye, you know, like what looks good. How can we, if we're going to hybridize mediums within animation or just animate in general, we have to know what looks good. It's beyond me, but you know, from the outside looking in, if you're the viewer, you know, because you're the one watching the show.
Yeah. To be fair, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's it. Go ahead. Thank you.
And to be fair, as long as like people continue to share their voices in terms of like, okay, no, this worked great as versus this looked terrible. Like in case of Land of the Lustrous, like it got a lot of positive attention because of the techniques that they used to make it look absolutely amazing. And then you have instances like, say, with the Dragon Prince on Netflix as well, which was kind of going for 3D modeled characters, but kind of shown at a rate that like a 2D animated show would be. And at first they had a bit of a rocky start because I think there was something wrong with the frame rate of the animation that they hadn't quite found that sweet spot yet. But as you see the show go from season to season, the look gets better. And you see a nice, not perfect, but a good experimental take on what it would take to merge, or again, play with the merging of those two styles. And then again, kind of going back to earlier this year, when I talked with Glenn Keane regarding Over the Moon, like that film, despite being a 3D production, definitely had a 2D backbone to it. So it's fascinating to see, and I'm really happy to see all these different ways to experiment with these two mediums. But I have to say, as far as visual aesthetic goes, and again, looking very unique, this particular method of bringing this just by adding light, a unique lighting and shadow and texture, it's amazing just those elements, how much they're able to bring everything to life in this film.
Yeah.
And I would, again, I would like to echo your thoughts, and I would absolutely love to see more people do this, whether it's the same studio or not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I'm kind of repeating what I said earlier a bit, but I really respect Pablos, even though this is his first film, because he was willing to kind of take that risk, I guess, at such an early stage in his career. Mm-hmm. We need artists like that, you know, that's how auteurs are born, right? People who have a very distinct storytelling style, whether it's thematically or visually. You know, who knows? It's too early to tell, but he might end up being one of those people, you know, someone that is remembered for his unique storytelling style and aesthetic that other artists refer to when they cite their inspirations, you know? So, yeah, but cool.
No, absolutely. And I do want to make one other mention, because this is like completely like out there trivia that I only just picked up on. I'll share the link of where I found this in the show notes below. Because it was a little bit of a short documentary on how the film got its look. And one of the things that they used, because at least everyone who out there who is an artist or is an animator knows that when you're capturing something or you're animating something, you almost always have a reference, whether it's yourself doing the character motions or even something as simple as the way the light is reflecting off something. Most of the time you have to go back and look for a reference. Well, I was really fascinated to find out, do you remember the scene where we get the, I won't go into too much into it, but where the whole concept of a kid getting a coal piece of coal in his stocking comes from?
Yes.
And the whole aftermath of that when you see that same child again. So I love that I think I found that in this documentary, they hinted at that scene where, Jesper and this kid kind of come out have a standoff was inspired by Breaking Bad.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, explain. That's juicy right there. Breaking Bad.
I mean, I don't really I don't really know too much of the details in terms of why that was inspired, but that was what they used for the lighting inspiration. So how the lighting reflected off the characters in that scene was inspired by a similar scene where they had similar lighting like that in an episode of Breaking Bad.
You know, that's really interesting. And it also shows, for people who have seen the film and know the scene, how the different elements of the film like need to complement each other. Because while Jesper's walking away, you've got that gangster music playing, you know, like
don't mess with the postman.
And you've got a lighting technique that was used in a gangster film or series. You know, that's really cool.
Animation's amazing, isn't it?
It is. And again, like Rachel, that's just a great example of the attention to detail that goes into just every single frame, every single scene. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I know. I was just like that. I heard that. I'm like, that's just too perfect, because I remember that like, when you first turn on Netflix and you have your little cursor above the clouds, even before you press like play or looking into the film details, like sometimes you know how a clip from the film or the show will kind of autoplay a little bit. And that's the scene that kept getting pushed. I think even when the film was first coming out in 2019, on YouTube, they like put out a promotional, because films like they like to put out like promotional clips, like a little snippets of the film, just so people can get a better idea than what's given in the trailers. And that was the scene that they pushed. And so I was very, like, even before I sat down and watched the film for the first time, I was already very aware of that scene. So it's kind of really funny that when they talk about that in this little informational video, I'm like, oh my God. It's inspired by Breaking Bad. That's amazing.
Yeah, but it works. Even though like Breaking Bad is like the polar opposite. Polar opposite. Wow. Yeah, but like literally the polar opposite of Klaus. It works. It works.
Inspiration, you know? Man. Inspiration. It comes from literally anywhere.
Like it, like we were talking in Fantasia, it, like literally you can get the idea for how lava bubbles are supposed to pop by just having a vat of mud and just making that bubble up. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not sure if there's any other notes that you wanted to talk about in terms of how this film was made that we didn't cover yet.
I don't have anything for production. I'm wondering for like character or story. We haven't talked about Margu or the Sami people. They have.
You know what? We didn't. I felt bad that I skipped that because Margu is absolutely the cutest child on screen. And she's my other favorite character of this movie. My three favorite characters are easily the boat guy, Alva, and Margu.
Yeah.
Hands down. Just because she's this sweet little Sami girl and she's like just speaking in her native language and she becomes like a conversation buddy for Jesper. And even though he has no idea what she's saying.
Yeah.
He doesn't take it bad at all. She's just very happy.
Yeah. She's probably many folks' favorite character because she's so innocent. I don't know if you want to talk about this. I was interested to see how the Sami people, like her community,
mm-hmm.
became like Klaus's assistants. Like they were almost a stand-in for Santa's elves. That's one thing we haven't really elaborated on a ton.
So far
is this whole story just completely like redefines the Santa Claus story in more ways than one. You've got two guys working together and you have a fictionalized setting, but a pseudo-historical grounding that almost makes this tale believable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the Sami people are an actual ethnic group. Like I think like it was Russia or Scandinavia. They're not fictional. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that they ended up being Klaus's helpers. Like, oh, this could have actually happened. There could have been a guy living up there, you know, with all these folks who were, you know, ingratiated to him and wanted to help make toys. That makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. Yeah, you're right. That's the kind of that historical grounding because obviously we can't just have elves appear out of nowhere to start helping him make toys. But and it's interesting. Again, it's probably the most emotional linchpin of the film, which leads to the actual part of him actually going back and making toys. Because something that the film hints at early on is that when he has all those toys, he made those long ago, and he hasn't really made any sense.
Yeah.
Up to a certain point in the film where Jesper's encouraging him to go back into it. But he then again, I won't spoil the reason why, but it's very clear that he's adamant. It's a big deal when he starts making toys again. And when he does, he fortunately gets help with these, the Sami people who he's through helping Margu, that they, you know, they're grateful for them helping her. And then the rest of her people, they come over and like, oh, we're going to help you out.
Yeah. And it's a magical sort of, you know, friendship, you know. I mean, there are a lot of friendships in the film, but the Sami people become Jesper's friends and Klaus's friends. And maybe just me, Rachel, but, you know, I think something that's really just broadly speaking about the story, interesting about Klaus, you know, having kind of discussed that half historical truth, you know, or believability behind it is there isn't much magic in this story.
Not really at all.
There's one moment at the end, and you know, the irony is that it feels like a very magical tale, like probably one of the most magical Christmas films I've seen personally.
But in a different way than most people would define as magic, because it's, I would say, almost semi-spiritual, I guess, to a degree.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like I said, there's no elves, there's no magic reindeer. I mean, obviously, I love the way they explain the magic reindeer and the flying sleigh. Yes. That, again, I won't spoil for people, but just like, oh my God, that is so funny. That is so good.
That was funny.
That was most excellent. That's like one of the best scenes in the movie. They handled that very well. Just even just the incorporating the reindeer into the into when they're taking the presents, like just watching Jesper flounder around as he's trying to get the reindeer to cooperate.
Yeah. I am. Maybe yeah, it's in my head, but I wonder if there was some sort of intent behind that. Like, was Pablo's, you know, trying to make a point by making the story somewhat more believable, even though the setting is fictional, but there's no like fantasy involved. Like in another world, maybe this could have actually happened, you know?
I would wager it's intentional. It's very much intentional because again, there are elements of this, you know, Santa Claus, those stories like the magic reindeer, the sleigh, elves helping in the workshop. You've seen them everywhere. And we've seen multiple interpretations of, okay, are the elves adults? Are they children? Are they, you know, are they creatures from another world? Are they, et cetera, that kind of thing. But I think that because of the fact that it kind of not necessarily discards those elements, but gives them a more realistic or more like a realistic grounding to them, or historical grounding, as you were alluding to, that again gives this film its own unique identity.
It does. And it makes Santa Claus more believable for, you know, the cynical child or the cynical adult, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I personally felt like my own faith in Santa was kind of restored almost through this film. Mm-hmm. That's why I like it so much, if that makes sense.
No, well, especially the whole idea, because a lot of people, with the whole idea of the tale of Santa Claus is the fact that, you know, it's the act of giving the gifts to others is the that's the special part of that tradition, is getting something for someone you love and then seeing their reaction upon receiving that gift, not knowing it's not just because it's something they want, but because it came from you and that you cared enough to pay attention to their wants and needs, that you went out of your way to make sure that you got something to make them happy. And that is basically the whole theme of this film. And I love that it really kind of finds other ways to lean into that with, especially with the kids who are, you know, they get, you know, they're getting these toys and are, you know, getting little sparks of joy whenever they get one. But then especially when they're introduced, like, oh, you have to be a good kid in order to get presents. Well, then that just starts a whole slew of good deeds throughout this very grim and cynical town.
Yep.
And it's those acts of giving, of being kind, of that kindness, and that's those, as Klaus himself says, those selfless acts, maybe even though they might not entirely be selfless, you know, they're still wanting toys, but it's still that act, that the physical act of kindness that helps trigger the town to evolve and change from the way it was to something new.
And that's the true spirit of Christmas. That's basically what Santa Claus, if we're, you know, describing Santa as more of an idea or like a spiritual energy, is. Because Klaus was a man, right? But the selflessness that he and Jesper like collectively like instilled in the community is something that would continue forever.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
go ahead. That's it.
And we're probably going to be getting close to wrapping up soon, but there's something I realized when I was rewatching this film this week and before, you know, getting ready for this episode. Oh, man, like I'm trying to think like the right way to say this, because, you know, 2020 has been one hell of a year. We can all agree that, agree with that. But I feel like, especially with, at least in, I know here in the US, there's never been a time where I think the whole idea of giving and sharing kindness as opposed to hatred and vile has been like, that's so important right now, like so incredibly important. And I feel like it almost feels like, to a degree, like it's like we're in Smearensburg and it's just like everything's just, you know, people are getting at each other's throats and pointing fingers and just like that's. But it's amazing how, despite how bleak that can be, those acts of kindness, however small, start to build and build something better. So even if you see something online or you see news or like It's like, oh, this is awful. This is terrible. One of the best things you can do to be, to help affect your community is by those small acts of kindness, even yes. for someone who, for example, you might not agree with, who might have different political beliefs than you do, who might, you know, regardless of what religion they, you know, that they go, you know, that they are part of, or any, or whatever the color of their skin might be, just acts of kindness. Those are so, so important. Those small things can really affect a community. And I just think, again, this is something that I think it impacted me a lot more this year after everything that's gone on, more so than when this came out in 2019. And I hope I'm not the only one who takes something like that to heart.
No, you're definitely not. I agree with you. And I'm sure that most everyone listening would too. We need stories like this now more than ever to be reminded of what matters, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, human beings are, you know, complicated creatures. We wrestle with our own selfishness a lot. Mm-hmm. And when our conscience is put under pressure in situations like COVID, it can be easy to make bad choices, selfish choices. And stories like this keep us grounded, right? I think, mm-hmm. Rachel, you've very eloquently kind of summed up the importance of the film. Yeah. So if you're listening into this, animation fans, I'd agree. That's probably the biggest takeaway. Mm-hmm. It reminds us to be good people.
Yeah,
that's the power of storytelling.
And not everyone, and again, there's not everyone is going to be open to that kindness all the time, because I mean, even, and you'll see in this film, if you haven't seen it already, like, it takes a while for those acts of kindness to really start to open other people up. And even then, there are some people who refuse to open up because they just don't want to. Like, case in point, the two clan leaders of both the Crumbs and the Ellenbows, they tooth and nail will never just refuse to let go of that hatred that they have for each other.
Yeah. So most, it's not, of their family did, but you're right, that enmity between the two leaders never really did resolve itself. So there's an element of realism to the film's conclusion too, right? I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rachel, but
no, it's okay.
That was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Which is, it's a reflection of reality too. Like, you know, kindness changes a lot of things and can open up hearts to, you know, to each other. But again, it is the choice of the person whether they want to open their heart or keep it closed. Yeah. And you're never going to know that right away, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
Yeah.
And treat people with love and respect, no matter what. So, yeah, sorry to end this on such a emotional note, guys, but I think that's kind of where the years kind of left me. We want to give a shout out to all of our other podcasting guests and commentators who joined us this year. You guys make Animation for Adults what it is. And thank you so much for everything that you've done, and have a happy, happy holiday. And as well as all of our listeners, again, the podcast as well as the website's gone through some tremendous growth this year, despite what's been going on with COVID-19. So again, thank you for continuing to stay tuned to the website and check out new articles, hopefully coming from Evan here, who's been one of our wonderful new writers and co-commentators. So keep an eye out for future stuff coming from him. We'll make sure, in terms of social media, we'll get to that in a second. I also want to do, before we sign off for the year, also send out much love and pride to the folks at Animation Nights New York and Yvonne, our good friend, who's also really come in leaps and bounds with adapting to the situation with Animation Nights New York and still making a venue where people can share their animated films, even in a virtual setting, which is huge. Yeah, we've been through a lot, but I want to make sure that we send out a note with, you know, everyone who's been involved some way, shape, or form with this website and this podcast for the year 2020. We love you all. We are excited to see what's going to happen next year. But for the meantime, I think it's good for all of us to just kind of sit and kick back and enjoy the holiday season, whatever form that takes for you. So if you still want to, you know,
check out what's, you know, look at other podcasts that we've recorded. You'll definitely find that on our website at mhforadults.com, as well as a few other podcasting venue sources, which I'll make sure we have listed in the show notes below. As well, keep in touch for next year for those, our social media avenues, Twitter, Pinterest, as well as Facebook, Tumblr, and am I forgetting one? Oh gosh, there's always one. Instagram. I forgot we have an Instagram. Okay, that's the one. That's the one. The pictures one. the picture Facebook. Evan, if you want, if anyone wants to follow you on your social media, what would you recommend?
I just have Facebook, unfortunately. But if anyone has a work appropriate question about the magazine or some constructive criticism, I wouldn't mind a DM.
Okay. Cool. All right. Yes. So. Yep. And if Rachel, you want to if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Fail2Ninja, as well as Instagram on at the same address, Fail2Ninja. I am mostly on Instagram, though, putting up pictures of my cat and whatever cool animation I'm currently obsessed with. All right. Well, I think that might just about wrap us up for the year 2020, guys. So, like I said, enjoy your holidays, however, whatever shape they take this year. And we will see you or you'll hear us again when we get into 2021. All right. Signing off. Bye-bye.
Of the world into one place, you'd end up with something very much like Key Largo. Key Largo is not only the gateway to the Keys, it's the launching point for the untamed Florida Everglades. In fact, from snorkeling our living coral reef to fly fishing the Everglades backcountry, Key Largo offers the best of both worlds. For more about Key Largo and the latest safety protocols, visit flakeys.com/keylargo.
At Busch Gardens Christmastown, rekindle the spirit of holiday traditions for you and your family. Delight in the wonder of over 10 million twinkling lights. Cherish the moments as you enjoy new holiday shows and visit Santa and Rudolph. And immerse yourself in a world transformed by the season at the world's most beautiful theme park. The holidays shine brightest at Busch Gardens Christmastown. Select dates through January 2nd. Right now, it's the best deal of the season. Save over 50% with tickets as low as $24.99. Restrictions apply.